You're listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we hear from Robin Broad and John Kavanaugh, co-authors of The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. The book tells the story of how local activists in El Salvador mobilized a broad coalition of religious leaders, labor unions, environmental activists, and international allies to protect the country's fragile water supply from the interests of a powerful global mining corporation. The inspiring story provides insights into how communities, countries, and corporations can begin to navigate more intentionally the shift to a renewable energy economy and the extraction of resources necessary to power that shift. It also shares the story of extraordinary, ordinary people who put their lives on the line to protect their land, their water, and their communities. John and Robin, thank you so much for being here with us today. First of all, let me congratulate you on the brilliant telling of a very important story. I wonder if we could start by telling me how you got involved in this story. Why did you write the book?
So first of all, Lauren, let us thank you for having us on this podcast. It's really a pleasure to be doing this with you. It's a great question how we got involved, because actually we weren't supposed to be involved. That it was truly serendipity, or depending on your audience, maybe whoever's listening, maybe fate. It was either serendipity or fate, but we got involved. John's organization, the Institute for Policy Studies, which is based here in DC, selected a national network of Salvadoran water defenders to win the Institute's prestigious annual human rights award in 2009, so over a decade ago. Five water defenders from El Salvador were to come to Washington, D.C. to get that award in October 2009. But 3 months before the award ceremony, and I have to tell you, I have goosebumps even saying this, 3 months before the award ceremony, we received the shocking news that one of the five water defenders who was to come to DC, the teacher and cultural worker Marcelo Rivera, had been brutally assassinated. His tortured body was found in the bottom of a deep dry well. We were horrified. And in October, the water defenders still came, and in Marcelo's place came his younger brother and best friend, Miguel. In that period, in those few months between Marcelo's murder and the award ceremony, the mining corporation had started a legal case against El Salvador in a little known, actually at that point, quite secretive arbitration venue that's part of the World Bank Group. The water defenders knew little about this venue. And after the award ceremony, when we were talking with Miguel and others, he asked us, given our background, if we would help them figure out what this arbitration venue, this International Center for International Settlement Disputes, ICSID, what it was all about and how the fate of their hometown could possibly be decided in a room in Washington, D.C. At that point, we knew about the World Bank. We had done research on it for some years. We didn't know a lot about this tribunal, but we did what we think anyone listening would do, talking to the brother of someone who's just been assassinated. We said, of course, we'll do some research. At that point, we expected that we would do a day or two of pro bono research. Little did we know that that would turn into a decade, more than a decade, of some of the most rewarding work of our lives.
Wow. John, did you want to add to that?
No, I'll just say we give this human rights award in the names of two of our colleagues at IPS who were assassinated, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, each year. So great people come through, they stay for a day or two and they leave. One thing that gave us a clue that this group was special is that we normally say we'll bring two of your members to the award ceremony. They said, we want to bring five. And they said, we want you to organize a tour of our people through the United States and through Canada. So they organized us as opposed to vice versa. And once they got here, as Robin described, we became friends. Respect was built through mutual work. And that's what created such important international work that led ultimately to some victories.
That's pretty incredible. It seems like they really understood the opportunity that that trip would afford.
Right.
Yes. That's great. So, you know, your book has been called A David and Goliath Story. You really start the book with a punch to the gut. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what motivated the people in your book, like Marcelo and Vitalina and the other farmers, to become water defenders and frankly risk their lives to lead the charge to protect watersheds in El Salvador. And a second question to follow up with that would be how they got others to join them in this journey.
So let me begin with the first part of your question, which is the punch to the gut part of the question. So we begin this book with Marcelo's murder because we wanted the reader not just to begin with a punch to the gut, to quote you, Lauren, yeah, but also to begin where we actually began, where we got into the story. We are not specialists on El Salvador. We have lived in the Philippines, we know other countries, and we are really specialists on the global institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and the WTO. But we wanted the reader, we actually felt we had no choice but to have the book and the reader begin where we began, with the horrifying realization that murder can be the cost of protecting the environment in many countries around the world. We, of course, knew that people disproportionately poor and people of color in the US and other countries are killed slowly by what's called the slow violence from chemical poisoning of air, water, and land, by global mining companies, by agribusiness, by fossil fuel companies, by all kinds of mega projects that are located largely within those poorer communities. Yet in the United States, seldom do people get murdered for leading these fights for water, for environmental justice. The best source for the statistics on this is the nonprofit Global Witness, which does these chilling calculations of how many people around the world are assassinated each year simply because they are environmental defenders. And it turns out in countries like El Salvador and Philippines and other countries, it's the most dangerous occupation. To defend the environment can get you killed. And Marcelo, we begin with Marcelo's disappearance and then the finding of his badly tortured body, because we want that reality to be where people begin, to knowing that's the cost. At the same time, we at least give hints, and you already said it, this is a David versus Goliath story where David actually wins.
Right.
Yeah, and to pick up, you asked Lauren how they got involved. These are, as we say in the subtitle, ordinary people. Mining companies started coming in the early 2000s because mineral prices were going up. People were buying more cell phones, computers, gold is used as a conductor in basic electronics, as well as jewelry and other things. But the price was going up. So mining companies were coming back to countries they'd abandoned when gold prices were low, and El Salvador was high on their list. And they promised jobs, they promised big revenues, prosperity. They give 1% of their profits to the local government. This sounded inviting. Marcelo and Miguel and Vitalina thought it sounded good from the start. They were very honest to us. And then they said, why don't we go check out our friends in Honduras? There are a lot of mines there. And let's see, we've heard stories that aren't so positive. And so they crossed the Lempa River, this big river in El Salvador that provides water to half of the population. They visited a big mine there in Honduras. And there they saw the horrible environmental damage that comes from the fact that gold is mined on a large scale using cyanide to separate the gold from the rock. Highly toxic, very hard to contain. And in the Honduran mine, they saw the results as cyanide-laced water went down the rivers, it killed the fish, it gave them skin diseases. And they also saw the conflict that comes from money coming in, big money coming in to local governments. So that's when they said, we've got to learn more about this themselves. They went and visited other mines. They studied hydrology, they studied mining. And then when they were convinced that this was not the right path, that short-term financial rewards for the few would be way offset by the environmental harms to the broader community, they did some of the most creative education and organizing that we've ever seen. Robin started with Marcelo and said he was a cultural worker and a teacher. He was incredible. He also organized with humor. He led marches with people wearing clown noses, marches of laughter. They involved local community radio stations that did skits on water. They did an enormous amount and convinced the people in their area that this would be bad for them. Now, one other thing I'll just say, many people have watched fights between communities and big corporations around the world. The corporations usually win, so those are the Goliaths. The David usually lose. What was intriguing here, though, was that the groups on the ground said, we don't want to just get this company out of here. We want to do two other things. We want to, one, defeat this lawsuit that Robin mentioned at this tribunal in the World Bank in Washington. They had no idea how they were going to do that. And two, they said, not only do we want this company out, we think that it is unsafe to mine in all of El Salvador, given that it is a water poor country. And so they said, we want a national ban. And from the very start, we started this in 2009, Robin and I sat there and just said to each other, oh my gosh, these people, good luck with this. But we felt it was important to be involved in the fight, even though we were almost sure we would lose, because of the larger story it told, one about mining and the environment versus short-term corporate profits, and also because it really exposed the unjust nature of some of the global rules, in this case, this tribunal.
Just let me add, I'm not sure we ever said to each other, oh my gosh, they're not gonna win. I think we said it to ourselves, sure. but we never said it out loud, because there was so much energy and what we call creative audacity. And it seemed like an unwinnable fight, but unwinnable fights can always be won if you have the right calculus, the right combination of creative audacity, smarts, and other things that I'm sure we'll talk about when you in response to some of your other questions.
Sure. Well, an unwinnable fight that must be fought, right? I mean,
right.
That, yeah, there was no choice. Well, I mean, I think that that's one of the themes that comes out of the book so strongly, is the importance of effective coalition building. And I love to hear about the humor and sort of a way of reframing it so that it's not, you know, I think it was sort of creating a champion for something rather than against. And there are champions for water, right? And for the communities that rely on that water. Can you talk about that coalition building and how you can pull out lessons that can be applied outside of the context of El Salvador, and even possibly outside of the context of sort of water defense, but like just environmental defense more broadly, and what are the lessons that these community leaders and civil society can use in their own, I don't want to say fights, but challenges against, you know, big power players.
So just to say where we left you, Lauren, just a second ago, is they were organizing across their whole province. They were doing this very creative education. They realized very quickly that they were just one of 14 provinces in the country. They would not win if it was just in their province. So pretty early on, they went to the capital city and started to talk to what they thought were likely allies. And the decision was to create a national coalition. It's called the National Coalition Against Mining in El Salvador, National Roundtable. And there they went to faith groups in a country that is very heavily, the Catholic Church is very strong. They went to environmental groups, they went to women's groups, they went to youth groups. They even went to unions, because there wasn't much mining in El Salvador, and therefore the unions in the end said that they were fine with the fight against mining once they learned of the environmental dangers. So they built a really effective national coalition that could reach to people all across the country. But then, and this is where we started the story, in 2009, when they won the Human Rights Award, they realized that they were up against such odds, not just a big company, but a government which was heavily tempted to take the offers of the mining companies and let the mining companies in. So they then turned to us at the Institute for Policy Studies, to Rob and to other allies, and asked for help in building a coalition at the global level. And we constructed what became known as International Allies, linked with the National Roundtable. And we went to a lot of the same groups. Of course, here in the United States, we also turned to the big, huge Salvadoran diaspora, maybe 2 million Salvadorans living in the US, many in the national capital region around Washington, but also to environmental groups like the Sierra Club and to unions. We got actually the Global International Trade Union Confederation, representing about 170 million workers, to put pressure on the tribunal, say this is an unjust case, this case should be dismissed. And so this is part of what's fascinating. You have coalition building at the local level, at the national level, and at the global level, all around this very stark case of an environmental injustice. And let me turn it back to you, Rafa, then with lessons.
Among the lessons we pull out that I think are really important to share is, first of all, it's really key that there was a grassroots social movement. So it began, the anchor was always the frontline communities. They were the ones who took the lead, and they were the ones who set the goals. And I think that's really key for why this worked as well as it did. And I'll not repeat what John said about coalition building, but so it built up from the grassroots. We always talk, I'm a professor, we always talk about the need to build up from the grassroots, but it's really easy to say and very hard to do. Secondly, to repeat something that we've said, they didn't call themselves anti-miners. They called themselves the water defenders. In the US, communities use the word water protectors. It's basically the same thing. It's just a different word. But they saw their goal as a positive one. So that seems to be a second really key lesson. They weren't gearing this to focus groups and what would win. It was truly what they believed. They were not anti-mining, and they don't like to be called that. Yeah. They were water defenders, water protectors. And that positive goal led them to reach out in ways that they wouldn't have been able to reach out if it had been just an anti-mining. And that's the third lesson, and I won't go on for much longer. The third lesson is building from that social movement with its positive goal. And as John said, it's incredible use of laughter. And this came from Marcelo. And when one learns more about Marcelo and his use of laughter, and one sees why it was that he was assassinated, that he was the first assassinated, because he was so good at what he did. He was what we call an ordinary, extraordinary person. But that positive framing allowed them to bring in not just the likely allies, not just the environmentalists or the human rights advocates, not just people who were on the left during the civil war in El Salvador, but it allowed them to, in El Salvador, reach out to unlikely allies. And we can tell some of those stories if you'd like in a different answer, but the unlikely allies included the archbishop, the head of the Catholic Church, very important in El Salvador, and someone who was conservative. There was not an expectation that this archbishop would be on the water defender's side. It allowed them to reach out to businessmen, because it turns out business people in El Salvador needed water more than they needed gold. There was not mining happening, and there weren't people who had large financial reasons to be pro-mining. And so they built that coalition nationally, that coalition of likely and unlikely allies. It would be, they reached across the aisle, as we would say in a US context. They brought in right parties, they brought in left parties. And remember, El Salvador had gone through this horrible civil war for more than a decade, starting in 1980. So it wasn't as if you bring people in a room and they easily get along. People had suffered horrible losses because of those on the other side of the aisle. And so just agreeing to do this, it was an audacious move, but they knew they had to do it to win. And then finally, they knew they had to go global, and they went global. So I think this last key lesson is that corporations are now global. It's very rare that we have a corporation that is simply, in these big fights, that is simply a domestic corporation. So the corporation was Canadian, Australian, with some US interests. That was global to begin with, but then also the fight at the World Bank arbitration venue was global. So the water defenders, in order to win, had to go global too. And that event in October 2009 at the Institute for Policy Studies began the global alliance work. And the final thing I will say in that is that that coalition work was done really, really carefully. So both sides, both Salvadorans and those in international allies, had to build up trust. You can't just jump into this and say, okay, we're here to help you. We're the people with the graduate degrees. Graduate degrees are great. I'm a professor. Graduate degrees are great. But you can't just jump in assuming that you have the expertise. And part of why it worked is that international allies, we respected and understood that people in El Salvador, especially on the grassroots, they had the expertise on El Salvador. They needed to decide if they wanted to have mining banned in El Salvador. That was their decision. It wasn't ours. Our role was to take guidance from them, and they then had to trust us on the global level.
Carry their message forward.
And that trust is so important.
Yeah.
That understanding that the expertise, the people on the ground have expertise, people in San Salvador have expertise, and people outside have different expertise. And if you bring it together, I mean, that's part of the lesson here.
Yeah. It's a really extraordinary story. I think you could probably go on and on about the lessons, but you pulled out some really important ones there. So thank you for that. I think that we've seen an alarming rise in the violence against environmental defenders. And I think that that's something that's made it into the headlines over the last couple of years. You mentioned Global Witness. Their 2019, the 2020 report reported that there were 212 environmental defenders killed in 2019, which was the highest number yet. And some of those numbers are concentrated in places like Colombia. But we also know that the indigenous communities are often the ones on the front lines and represent a disproportionate number of victims. But this isn't an issue that's going away, right? With the mining, especially, you know, even I think about the transition to renewable energy and all of the resources and critical minerals that are going to be required for that. And so we have to be thinking about how we approach this better so that we're not putting people in the position where they're defending, you know, ecosystems and natural resources with their lives. So I'd be curious to hear from you what kinds of actions the international community, development and conservation communities, the private sector can take so that we're not getting to this point where people are putting their lives on the line to protect their communities and their livelihoods and their access to natural resources that are so intimately tied to their well-being. You know, so I guess preventative. What needs to take place in the very early stages of decision-making so that you've included those local voices and that local knowledge in these big decisions?
Great. Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I would say at the end of the day, what Robin and I concluded after we got deep into mining and the huge revelation to us that mining is so dangerous. It's, by the way, dangerous both for workers. It's one of the three most dangerous professions in the world. And most of the stories people know about mining are things like Chilean miners getting trapped underground and extraordinary efforts to rescue them. So it's both dangerous to workers and incredibly dangerous to the environment. We talked about cyanide. There's other big issues. There's sulfides around. Once you break the rock open, that when water hits them, turn into sulfuric acid and leach other toxic substances like iron into the soil and water for centuries. We're still dealing with problems from Roman mines in Spain and England from 2000 years ago. As that became clear to us, and in an industry where there's so much money involved, gold, $1,800 an ounce, so lucrative, that inevitably there will be violence and danger around it. And therefore, in the long term, we concluded that probably half of the mines in the world need to be closed down, that they're in places either that are sensitive, as you put it, indigenous communities, sensitive biodiversity regions, subject to earthquakes, typhoons, about half of the, or this, the presence of sulfides near the gold. We need to close down half of the mines. Now, the good news is already most nations in the world are poised for a huge shift now from fossil fuels to clean energy. People know that it's key to survival, driven by climate. What we need is massive education on the dangers of mining that link mining in with the climate issue. It's very similar. Water is key in both of them, and water is in danger in both of them. And just as there are millions of good jobs in the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy, there are millions of good jobs in the massive recycling of the metals and gold that we already have in the world today. At the end of the book, we mentioned that about 30% of the metals we use in this country are recycled. If you could get that up to 80, 90%, you could cut out half of the mining in the world. So that's the key answer here, is this is an industry which is at its very core toxic, and we need less of it. You mentioned, Lauren, that in this huge transition, and the US is right now in the middle of it towards clean energy, electric cars will be central. Electric cars, batteries use lithium. Lithium also cannot be mined in a way that is safe. It uses huge amounts of water, pollutes water. It's dangerous in other ways. So we need, one, not more cars, but fewer cars. We need electric cars, a huge shift. And we will need massive recycling around those batteries. So there is an answer, and an answer that could provide millions of good jobs all around the world, but it requires the kind of mind shift that people are going through right now around climate. And by the way, let me say one other thing. The story in El Salvador has inspired a new wave of thinking in many developing countries about the path forward. Previous to the Salvadoran win, most countries followed that had minerals followed one of two paths. Either the free market government said, let's mine as much as we can and use the revenues for our general coffers. Socialists like in Bolivia, Ecuador under Correa and others said, let's mine a lot and use it for social programs for the poor. What the Salvador win, they became the first country in the world to ban all mining in metals mining in 2017. It opened the door to a third path. And we're seeing this in many countries around the world, politicians emerging. We just saw this in elections in Chile. We saw it in the presidential elections in Ecuador where an indigenous leader, Yaku Perez, got 20% of the vote in the first round on an anti-mining platform. More and more, there is a path that says, let's protect the environment first, let's protect and lift up the rights of indigenous people, and let's exclude mining from our development path. And that is gaining traction all around the world. So this isn't, in this sense, it's the vote heard around the world, this vote in the Salvadoran legislature. It is inspiring social movements and governments in other parts of the world.
Let me just add very quickly that we are told by some people who've read the book that they started the book thinking we were going to end with, so let's get rid of all mining. And they were waiting for that. And they were waiting to disagree with that. Because if you look around you, I mean, nice headsets, nice cell phone, John. Oh, I like your laptop, right? We use metals. We need metals. So just the same way, this is not a magical romantic story about David versus Goliath. It's not a fairy tale. It's a story where about the blood, sweat, and tears that it took, about the lives lost before David could beat Goliath. But it's also, we don't write it as a pie in the sky. There's no way to solve that. That's the reality as we see it. There is a way to solve it. And we can easily be on that path. It's really important that people understand the cost of mining and understand it's not something where you can't just sit around a table and agree, okay, let's do green mining. Let's do green mining, or there's no such thing as green mining. You actually have to figure out where mining can happen,
and where it can't happen. And we can't just solve this by all of us buying 3 electric cars instead of 3 gas guzzling cars. We have to build up mass transportation. We have to change the way we think about these things.
Right.
That doesn't mean we can't have cars. We can have cars. I mean, this isn't right. a book. This isn't a story about how we all need to go back to some other way of some past way of living. We can actually, it's a story about redefining progress in a way that hopefully works to the benefit of the majority of the population of the world rather than just to an elite few. Right. So it's a hopeful story, even though it may not sound it from everything we've talked about.
No, of course. I mean, I think we talk about, you know, the need to expand the toolbox and in our approach to development and in our approach to protecting communities. And that means also expanding the table to make sure that you have the right voices in for the beginning of decisions and the beginning of not decisions necessarily, but planning and thinking about what would be best for sort of all of the stakeholders involved. And so not waiting until, you know, a decision's been made that's gonna really upend lives and livelihoods and lead to the kind of conflict. Would you say there's any success stories with mining? Are there places you would point to where things have been done well?
Well, there are definitely countries that have taken steps to limit the horrible impacts of mining. Costa Rica based its whole development model on ecotourism, and it has stopped most mining in order to preserve about a quarter of the country is in national parks. And they've made their standard of living is the highest in Central America around that different development model. In Panama, they've stopped mining in indigenous areas in the south. In Argentina, 7 of 21 provinces have stopped mining. So other countries in Colombia, being very conscious that much of the water comes from the highlands, they've stopped mining, banned mining in the highlands. So many countries are taking steps to protect areas that should not be close to mining. Argentina has banned mining around glaciers. That should be a no-brainer, but they used to mine near glaciers. So very important steps in those directions all around the world. Also great reforms, by the way. The other piece of this story that we got into a bit is the global economic rules that allow corporations to sue governments, in this case at this World Bank Tribunal. There's a lot of work being done to transform those rules so that the rights of communities, the rights of indigenous people have the same power as the rights of corporations, or greater power than the rights of corporations.
So as John just suggested in his response, to the extent there's been success stories, it's more by government action. It's more success because government has outlawed mining in certain areas, or has said, in the case of Costa Rica, for instance, Costa Rica doesn't allow cyanide in mining, and it doesn't allow new open pit mining, what we call the kind of in Appalachia where you remove a whole mountain to get to a mine. And governments where they're strong enough to actually implement that policy. So that's really what we need to be looking for in this transition, is obviously not just led by governments, led by, as we said, by communities, by social movements, but governments turning that in, as they did in El Salvador.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think
policy.
Going back to the coalition building, that it seems to me that the coalition of actors in El Salvador is what sort of empowered the government to take action too, right? So it's that it's sort of that feedback loop, and you need civil society to help drive some of that higher level decision making and empower the governments to take those decisions.
Absolutely, there were polls done in El Salvador by the key university there that showed that the majority of the population was against mining. So in the 2009 presidential election, both the right and the left candidates came out strongly against mining. Now, we can't do a hypothetical and say, if those polls hadn't been done, what would have happened? But our sense and part of our hope
in terms of the future for El Salvador is the strong public opinion against mining is going to keep a government, a future government, the current government, a future government, from backtracking on mining, from approving mining. And yeah. Again, El Salvador is a small country that has this one main watershed. So you can't say, okay, let's just do mining here, or let's just do mining thing here. It's one of the things that the water defenders from Northern El Salvador realized pretty early on, that their goal in this coalition in La Mesa had to be to ban mining everywhere, because there was nowhere in El Salvador that it could be done safely.
It's really an extraordinary story. I could talk to you all day, and I hope that we will have another opportunity soon. I really want to thank you for your time today and for writing such an incredible book and being such an ally to these water defenders. Thank you so much, Robin and John.
Well, thank you for spending time with us, Lauren. It's been a pleasure. So we'll see you down the street at some point.
Yes, absolutely.
The coffee shop near your house.
Yes, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.